Hi, Ramesh.
Hi, Matt.
How's it going?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. I guess I've been, like everyone else, sort of seeing the news that Karl Rove is stepping down today, trying to process that and what it means.
Yeah, I guess he's stepping down effective at the end of the month. It was quite a surprise to me. I figured he'd be a bitter ender, but according to the news accounts, Josh Bolton told White House staff that if they didn't leave soon, they would be expected to stay through the rest of the administration. And I guess if you believe the cover story, which I actually do, the Roves just didn't want to hang on that long.
Right.
But I think what this says is just how, this is just to sort of double and triple underline the point that the administration is over.
Right. I mean, it has, of course, prompted a certain amount of feverish speculation that he must be sort of skedaddling in advance of some kind of scandal.
Which I'm sure that Rove is enjoying.
Right. I mean, I guess I don't give a ton of credence to that, if only because... I don't know. Even if he is about to be implicated in something, that doesn't seem like a particularly good reason to leave in advance. It would be just as damaging for the White House, one way or the other. The fact that he may have resigned a month earlier, it isn't going to spare them from anything. And Bolton's explanation, I guess that you put it there, that, he just wants to... people have to get out now or I'll stay through to the end, makes sense. I wouldn't want to stick around in this White House for the next year and a half.
What I remember in, maybe it was late 05, early 06, Rove let go of his policy responsibilities and was supposed to do all politics all the time. And there was a flurry of stories about what this all meant. And it was just so sort of obvious that there was no policy agenda to shepherd through anyway, so it's not like he was really giving anything up. And now there's sort of no politics left either. So, one would have said 3 or 4 years ago that it was very hard to imagine a Bush administration without Karl Rove, at this point, it's not so hard because it's just sort of treading water.
Right.
And it's really down to Iraq and spending at this point. I think if you spoke to folks in the White House, they, some of them would basically, if they were being candid, tell you that.
Right. Although, that does seem like a substantial amount. I've read that we're supposed to look forward to like a sort of big showdown over the spending bills in the fall, which seems, that kind of thing is always politically tricky.
Yeah, for months and months now, starting really during the immigration debate on the right, I heard people in the administration saying, that the right will reunite during these spending fights, which strikes me as pretty dubious. I think actually, in a way, that's sort of connected to a sort of widespread misunderstanding of the politics of the last 30 years. I just don't think spending has actually motivated conservative voters in any serious way ever, and I don't think it's going to start doing so this fall.
No, I tend to agree with that, which is exactly what makes it seem, noteworthy to me that, insofar as the administration really is determined to sort of pick a big fight in which the Republican position is that they're gonna fight really hard for spending cuts. In a way, I guess they never did when the Republicans won the majority. That seems like a big risk to me, and not necessarily one I would want to undertake without the guy who'd been sort of my right hand political advisor throughout my entire career.
Well, especially if, as a lot of people seem to think, we're headed towards some sort of government shutdown in the fall, because. I know there is a school of thought that says the government shutdowns tend to favor the executive branch and that's why they were, the whole sort of procedurally this was instituted in the first place. But that does seem like an awfully big gamble, especially when you start out with the public not sympathetic either to you personally, to your party, or to your basic public policy position on spending.
Right. Because the precedent here was the one that happened in 95, right?
Right.
Between face-off between Clinton and Gingrich. And, it's really only one data point. One way to read that is that Clinton won because he was president. The other way to read it is that Clinton won because... because the public wasn't interested in spending cuts.
Right, and because he's a representative of the party of government, right? I mean, it, you know, if something sort of that looks kind of drastic has been done that's anti-government, people are just not going to blame the Democratic Party for that. You know, it's all through 95, 96, the Republicans' mantra was that they were saving Medicare from the Democrats, and that just struck me at the time as something that would be extremely counterintuitive for most people.
Right, and I mean, also,
it didn't work. Yeah.
I mean, it was actually true that the shutdown was a tactic that the congressional Republicans engineered. I mean, that was...
Yeah, that's right. That's another reason. I mean, yeah, you can't spend the entire fall saying, hey, let's have a shutdown. Shutdown will be fine. Nobody's even going to miss the government. And then when it happens, say, hey, no, this wasn't our fault. We didn't want this.
Right, and I mean, there seems to be the same problem this time around again. I mean, if the White House is going to telegraph a government
It's been doing
shutdown,
a lot less of that than the Republicans did in 95.
Right. No, I mean, I guess I first sort of saw hints of it. This week, but you know, I mean, there's a potential risk there, and anyway, I mean, it is odd in the context that Bush, I mean, I guess unlike your typical president, doesn't have like a political career that stretches beyond this one advisor. I mean, obviously he's had other people work for him, but Karl Rove has sort of always been
right
the major domo there.
You know, one interesting question that I think is raised by some of the by his resignation, and also by that Josh Green piece in The Atlantic, mm-hmm. To which you linked earlier this morning, is did Rove really believe in all of this realignment talk? And Green seems to suggest, yes, he did believe that there would be some grand Republican realignment. But I think one bit of context you have to remember is that for a long time now, Rove has played a kind of confidence game. You know, if you remember the closing days of the 2000 campaign, Rove and his people, the entire campaign was trying to talk up the idea that it was going to be a 3 to 5 point margin of victory in the popular vote, and the idea being, I think, that would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, that voters
right.
would want to back the winner, and so on and so forth. And I think you've seen that again and again during this presidency. And, you know, even sort of with the Social Security debacle in late 2004 and in the first half of 2005, there was a little bit of building on previous victories and trying to persuade Republicans who are ambivalent or worried, you know, well, if Rove and Bush are saying that this is what, you know, we should do, then they have to have a strategy behind it. This must make sense in some way or other when, in fact, you know, it turned
right.
out there wasn't any strategy.
No,
behind
you know,
it didn't make sense.
I mean, I always assumed all throughout sort of the end of 2004, early 2005, whenever I heard Rove talking about realignment, I always took that to be just like a kind of bluster. You know, what was interesting about...
Right, demoralize your opponents some more and
right.
drive the networks nuts.
Right, I mean, what was interesting about Josh's piece in that regard was that he had sort of other Republicans saying that, you know, that was the reason... the reasoning Rove had given them at the time for certain moves. Obviously, you know, there's no end to the number of people Karl Rove might have been trying to bluff. But it is one, you know, it's different to sort of maintain a line just purely for sort of public consumption in the press, and another thing to be, you know, saying it to members of Congress, so on and so forth, people on the Hill. So, I mean, I don't know. The article made it seem realer. Sort of my previous assumption had been.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's also, of course, people start to believe what they say.
Sure, right. No, I mean, that's true. I blogged this, my view is not even so much that Rove was mistaken about this, but that the whole idea of a realignment is sort of wrong. David Mayhew's a political scientist at Yale who looked at this in some detail and sort of found that there was no there. I mean, not that the sort of periods of Republican and Democratic dominance that people point to didn't really happen, but that, you know, the evidence that there's such a thing as a realignment per se, as opposed to a series of elections where, you know, events and skill and so forth led to one party winning, And, you know, I mean, I do think you see that with the sort of rapid speed with which we've switched from Democrats worrying about an era of perpetual Republican domination,
right,
to one in which Democrats are hopeful for, you know, a sort of endless reign of social democracy. And that, you know, what's turned here was that September 11th made Bush super popular. Then problems in Iraq have made Bush super unpopular. And, you know, sort of who knows what's going to happen 4 years from now.
Yeah, you know, one thing that has struck me is how rare in the if you tell the story of the Bush administration, it can look like there were long periods of great Republican victories, but there's actually been pretty rare in the administration to have sort of, so to speak, politically good times for the White House. Because if you remember, all through the fall of 2002. People were worried that Republicans weren't actually, I mean, Republicans were worried and Democrats were hopeful that Republicans were going to actually lose seats in 2002. And of course, 2004, for much of the year, Republicans were deeply worried about losing the election. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of Democratic strategists thought that it was Kerry's to lose. And then, of course, 2005 and 2006 have been sort of an unending train of disasters for the Republicans. So even though, you know, they ended up winning sort of 2000, they won 2002 and 2004, there actually hasn't been, you know, there hasn't been the sort of the psychological effects that you would expect would come along with the string of victories.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, in part that's because Bush's approval ratings got so high, you know, after September 11th, that there was really no place to go but down, you know, which is a little unusual. But then from the flip side, you know, I mean, you don't normally have a president sort of coming into office losing the popular vote in that kind of way. You know, when he governed, I mean, the signal thing about the Bush administration was that, contrary to expectations, he didn't come in and govern like a president who had lost the popular vote. You know, he governed very boldly. He acted on his agenda as he saw it. And, you know, during the periods when that's worked, that's looked like a stroke of genius. But at other times, it's made him very unpopular. He's never sort of seized opportunities to, in a big way, try to neutralize opposition with sort of bipartisan.
Well, you know, Tom Edsel's book, Building Red America, I think it was titled, I mean, he makes a big deal out of the idea that Republican voters are generally more comfortable with risk than Democrats are. And he says, you know, it's sort of strategy and policy. That's also true. And, you know, I mean, that book is sort of a rueful Democratic lament at how well the task of building this Republican coalition has gone. But, you know, it's the nature of big risks that sometimes they fail.
Right.
Exactly. You know, and we've seen that in several instances in this administration.
Right. Well, maybe, you know, from one Atlantic piece and one sort of Bush aide to another, there has been some discussion about this piece in the magazine written by Matthew Scully, sort of dumping on his boss, a former boss, Mike Gerson.
Right.
Have you seen that?
Oh, sure, yeah. No, this is an article that is of intense interest to a very small number of people.
Sure. But, you know, that's what we live for here on the Internet. I mean, they were both speechwriters. And Gerson, you know, as the piece lays out, sort of acquired this glowing reputation, you know, in the media and elsewhere, such that, you know, he was able to exit his job in the Bush administration to a spot as a Washington Post columnist and a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Scully basically accuses him of making a lot of stuff up. Well, not quite making up, but, you know, consistently cultivating and deliberately cultivating this image of himself in the press in a way that's inappropriate, I guess, for a speechwriter who should be in the background.
Well, he suggests that Gerson misled both other people at the White House and reporters.
Right.
And that he sort of went out of his way not to correct misimpressions that that helped his reputation. The, I mean, you know, one reads this thing and one has a number of reactions. I guess my first one was to wonder whether speechwriters all remember each and every line that they have that they wrote. And because one of the things Scully's remembering who wrote which part of which sentence in 2000.
Sure.
And you know, maybe that means that Scully is more inclined to keep score, or maybe that's just the way speechwriters are. I'm not sure. And the other question was whether Gerson's behavior, as depicted in the article, was merely careerist or actually pathological, and it seems that it went to such a length, again, assuming the truth of what Scully wrote,
sure,
that you'd have to say it crossed that line.
Right. Well, you know, I'm going to have to assume it's true since I work at The Atlantic, have confidence in the process.
Well, actually, maybe you could enlighten me about this. How would you go about fact-checking that piece? I mean, you know, did The Atlantic call up Gerson and say, hey, by the way, did you...
Look, honestly, I have to say, I have no idea. My job there has limited involvement with that side of the print operation. And I don't know what the process for that is. I mean, the article itself says that there are actual records that detail all this. It would be, I guess, truly pathological of Scully to sort of lay out where it is you will be able to check these facts, if he's not reasonably confident that, you know, at least that source of data will back him up. You know, for something like, sort of the funniest anecdote in the piece is soon after September 11th, Bush comes into a room with various members of his staff and says, "We're at war." And this becomes, in Bob Woodward's book, Bush saying, "Mike, we're at war." I don't know what kind of records would certify that one way or the other.
One can see the president repeating that line, though. You know, you might have said,
sure,
you know, "Laura, we're at war." You know, it's entirely possible.
No, it's definitely true that there have been days when, you know, I develop a witty aperçus or whatever, and will say them to more than one person as I encounter them. You know, on the other hand, from what you know of the oddity of Bob Woodward's books on Bush, he really does seem amenable to sort of changing his story according to, you know, what it is.
Right.
The last guy he talked to wants him to say happened.
A lot of factors make you believe Scully. I mean, I should declare at the outset, or I guess we're well away from the outset at this point, but I know Scully somewhat. I know him well enough, I think, to trust him on his recitation of facts. Maybe not well enough to say that his judgments about other people are always 100% right. But, you know, look, nobody gets a reputation in Washington, particularly nobody in the Bush administration gets the kind of reputation Gerson has without cultivating it. You know,
sure.
That doesn't happen by accident. And then there is, you know, things ring true. I mean, there is a sort of the specificity in the article, has the air of truth about it. And I guess the last thing, and I think this is a real sort of... I guess you'd have to call it the dog that didn't bark, is that, you know, in this article, Scully is more, he's sort of, you know, possibly sort of for rhetorical purposes, his grievance is not so much for himself, but for his colleague John McCollum.
Oh, sure.
And the idea is that Gerson is taking credit from both Scully and McCollum. And in the big pushback we saw over the weekend from the administration, from Pete Wehner, from Karl Rove, a lot of it was covered in the Washington Post on Saturday, John McConnell is not quoted. It says McConnell did not return phone calls. And it seems to me that that really does tend to corroborate Scully. Because
right.
There's really no cost for him to say, you know, everybody else in the administration is exactly right who is speaking out publicly. Gerson's a wonderful guy. I've never had any grievances against him. And, you know, that the fact that that hasn't happened. And you know, if McConnell is leaned on in the next few days to actually say something in favor of Gerson, I don't think that'll count. I mean, I think what's
right.
really telling is that the first opportunity that was given, he didn't take.
No, sure. He didn't just see it and say, oh, God, you know, this is all wrong. I can't believe Scully's using me like that. I think that definitely does tend to back him up. I do think Scully sort of puts forward the theory, the interpretive theory, that the media was sort of willing to buy this because they really wanted to have the sort of like the one good Bushy, and that Gerson was sort of given credit for the kind of more humanitarian sort of elements of Bush's political agenda. And there's a certain irony in that, because I do remember a brief period of time around when Scully's book came out, when, you know, he himself seemed to be sort of auditioning for that goal. You know, he's a conservative, but he's a vegetarian, you know, so liberals can love him, kind of thing.
Right. Now, there is something to that, but I think that Gerson did, you know, just get more of the, you know, more of that glow about him. I mean, I guess mostly because he was around so long. He was so influential, and of course he cultivated that reputation. Now, one thing I didn't get from an answer from that Scully article is I had the impression that Gerson was more important, or the speech writing team was more important than it usually is, that it seemed to have some real influence in pushing the administration, you know, in setting the administration's direction and setting out its themes. I mean, I suppose partly because the president himself is so famously inarticulate.
Right, but it's true. You know, I mean, you get that impression from David Frum's books that he, on some level, you know, sort of saw, not himself personally, but himself as part of the speechwriting team as sort of, you know, setting policies when they would put lines about, you know, people being with us or against us or freedom or this and that in the speech, that it wasn't that, like, the National Security Council had met and decided that this was going to be the policy and then forwarded that to the speechwriting office.
But in previous administrations, though, the president would not, I mean, a speech would have been vetted in that fashion. The president couldn't have said something without its really being the administration policy. This one was different. There wasn't that kind of vetting, I guess, for some of these speeches because nobody thought that they were going to set, right? I mean, they would set the themes, but there wouldn't be any actual policy follow through.
Right. I mean, maybe. It's a little hard to say what was happening there. I mean, you know, in the first term, I think you've seen a lot of reports that the kind of the interagency process on the national security side was being run very poorly on a whole number of fronts. And, you know, an inability to exercise any kind of control over what the president says seems to have been part of that. I mean, for example, we've seen that something like including Iran in the axis of evil at a time when mid-level Iranian officials were working with James Dobbins on various issues related to Afghanistan had sort of consequences in the real world. You know, they've consequences that people of a certain point of view, you know, approve of, but
well, you can see this, you know, you can see it in 2001. I mean, even before 9/11 with the surveillance plane that went down possibly over Chinese territorial waters and, you know, Richard Armitage, you know, number two guy at the State Department, is publicly contradicting the president in the aftermath of that about what our policy on Taiwan is.
Right. Yes.
With no repercussions that one could see.
No. I mean, exactly. I mean, it seems to be a serious problem. I mean, one that's maybe, I don't quite want to say that it's more under control now. If anything, it's that there seem to be fewer policy initiatives now. So this is perhaps less of an issue than it once was, but
well, and Rumsfeld and Powell are both gone, so that, you know, that removed a lot of the tension in the administration on foreign policy.
Right. I mean, there are fewer big dogs. There's a bit of a less sort of
I mean, one has the sense that both Rice and Gates are more inclined to be conciliatory within you know, inter-administration debates.
Right, and just substantively closer to each other on the merits of these things. No, I mean, that's true. I guess I don't really know how to put that in comparative perspective. You know, Jason DeParle's book on welfare reform suggests that the Clinton administration sort of got the whole ball rolling on this by just having a line in the speech about ending welfare as we know it without anyone on the campaign or Clinton himself having any particular idea of, you know, what that was
going to lead to.
Yeah, well, you know, or just, right, I mean, for, you know, I mean, they put it in because it sounded like a good idea, not because they had a good idea in mind that they wanted to advance. You know, so I guess these things happen, though it's a little distressing to, you know, those of us who like to think of a more rational process at work. I don't know. I guess we agree.
Well, we got to fight over something.
Sure. What did we have on the docket?
We've got this League of Democracies.
Yes, team Democracy. This has been, you know, this. So this is an idea that's sort of kicked around in a a lot of different forms. And sometimes you see the same person, like Ivo Dalder, who co-wrote the most recent op-ed on this with Robert Kagan. Sometimes I think endorsing it in a series of different kinds of forms. But the basic idea is that there should be an organization of democracies that would... there already is an organization like that, but it sort of doesn't do anything. The idea is to create a new one that would sort of claim for itself the right to authorize military interventions, you know, in cases when the Security Council won't.
Right.
Right. And this is something that I feel like its sort of main intellectual proponents have tended to be on the left, sort of more hawkish Democrat think tankers. Although it's gotten... It's
because they get to be hawkish and multilateral at the same time.
Right. Although it's... I mean, in practical politics, it's John McCain on the right who's endorsed it. I think your colleague, Jonah Goldberg, has written in favor of this.
Yes.
It seems incredibly confused and ill-advised to me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, here I think we're probably going to agree, but for slightly different reasons, because I think most of the critique of it, particularly that Paul Saunders op-ed that you linked to today in the Washington Post, Saunders makes, you know, a number of, I think, valid points and a number of points that I think aren't so great. But the basic critique seems to be the effect on the behavior of those powers that are not in the Democratic Club. Whereas from my perspective, the chief defect of this is... You know, if you want to have a club of the democracies making all these important decisions, it has to. It's inevitably going to be a club of the democracies that think it is important for democracies to have such a voice, right? I mean, it's going to be sort of people who believe a kind of neoconservative or liberal theory about the role of democracy in foreign policy.
Right.
So it won't actually be all the democracies. You won't have France. You know, when by the time you get rid of all the countries that, you know, for reasons of prudence, you know, because they want good relations with non-democracies and so forth, don't really want any part of this club, you're left with essentially, you know, the U.S., Britain, Australia, and the familiar cast of characters. So what's the advantage over an ad hoc set of alliances, you know, such as the one we currently enjoy?
Right. Well, you know, and I mean, you know, this is where... You know, I'm a real multilateralist and so forth, but I mean, I do think where the sort of the behavior of the major other powers, China in particular and Russia, comes in is that this creating of a sort of formal organization seems to be worse than just being ad hoc. Because, you know, if we behave in an ad hoc way, I think there's some downsides to that, but it's clear then that what we're saying is that the rules of the road are that these kind of things are handled on an ad hoc basis. And, you know, we'll have a relationship.
As opposed to we're going to have a menacing alliance that, you know, eventually wants a world revolution.
Well, it's just that, you know, if you formalize it, but then make it, as I think you suggest, this would sort of be a sham. But it would be making such grandiose claims on its own behalf that it's hard for sort of the other powers to not respond, you know, instead of just being able to say, well, okay, we're all sovereign countries here, and the U.S. and China will have an ad hoc, you know, bilateral relationship. For instead, the United States to sort of formally proclaim that we and this other group of countries just sort of think that other countries don't really count in some sense. You know, you're demanding a response. I mean, the U.S., for example, you know, couldn't just sort of sit idly by if other countries were banding together.
A league of autocracy?
Right, or whatever. You know, and just saying, well, you know, just not that we're saying we're going to invade Nicaragua, but, you know, we could if we wanted to. You know, people would freak out, and I think rightly so.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess my response to the idea that this is a bad idea because it's going to cause all these other countries to band together against us is it's not going to get to that point.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's a bad idea for the countries, you know, themselves that would be in the club, let alone the ones outside it.
Right. No,
so
it will never
get to the point of provoking that reaction. There might be some sort of League of Democracies. You know, I mean, like the existing one that you mentioned, whose name that everybody forgets, everybody's going to keep forgetting it because it's never going to be handed serious responsibilities.
Right. I mean, obviously, there's also just this sort of...
Unless we got to a world in which there were no non-democratic great powers.
Sure, yes. I mean, if all of the great powers had, you know, similar political systems and similar values, you know, they wouldn't need to...
Okay, we're gonna stop some flare-up in Somalia, all of us, you know, China and Russia and everybody.
Right.
So that would make some sense.
Yeah, I mean, maybe... Right.
You wouldn't, at that point, you wouldn't really need anything besides the UN anyway.
Right, exactly. There's this paradoxical quality to it. I mean, the UN, you know, people point out, the UN's critics will point out that, like, well, you know, the Communist Party of China and Vladimir Putin, you know, aren't great guys. And so, you know, why give them this kind of leverage? But at the same time, the Security Council set up the way it is for an actual reason, which is that... Mm. You know, an international institution that excluded several major powers making decisions, it just has no real advantages over the powers just doing it in an ad hoc way.
Right.
On their own. I mean, the point of the UN is that the Security Council's decisions represent a, like, bona fide consensus of all the countries that matter. Now, because the world is changing, that's starting to arguably not be the case in terms of India and and so forth, but certainly nothing has happened over the past 60 years that makes you think that, you know, ignoring the government of China's perspective has become a more viable way to do things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this idea of sort of a concert of democracy, it strikes me as one of those wouldn't it be great if ideas,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if all the world's democracies had a unified purpose and saw their interests as identical in foreign policy? Well, yeah, I suppose it would, right? I mean, especially if they were ours.
Right.
But since that isn't the world that we actually live in, this is a proposal of limited utility.
Right, well, and of course, the funny thing about it is, I mean, there's just something amusing about sort of American, you know, security policy elites writing op-eds about how all these other countries should join our alliance. You would feel that this had a better chance of getting off the ground if there were, like, op-ed writers in, Belgium and Bangladesh and Canada, you know, saying, well, we should really form an alliance like this and you know, with the United States at its lead. At this point in time, it hardly seems like, certainly, you know, the voting publics around the world are, like, clamoring to sign up for new versions of American military action.
Yes, not a propitious moment for this kind of proposal.
Right. I mean,
but they're thinking in the long run, right?
Wait, what?
I mean, but the people behind this proposal, you know, do envision it as kind of a long run thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Except they also, I think, you know, envision it as a short term political gambit. So it's a little hard to see, you know, what it's worth.
I think Kagan envisions going after Iran before this concert of democracies gets off the ground.
Right. But, short-term political gambits. Ames straw poll.
Oh, right, yeah,
right.
That.
What do you think? It was huge news for one day.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you know, the Huckabee second place showing, it was a surprise. It was a surprise to me. The question now is, you know, does it really matter?
Right.
Do these results matter? And I think, you know, it does mean that Romney is the king of Iowa. I mean, it does mean that he is favored to win the caucuses in Iowa. And then the question becomes, does that matter? And certainly Giuliani campaign boosters want to say no. And they'll say, you know, the whole map has changed, and Florida and California are really where this is going to be decided. I just think if Romney wins in Iowa and Giuliani doesn't do a very good second place, at least in New Hampshire, I think it's very hard for Giuliani to get the nomination at that point.
Right. I mean, well, what's left out of here, though? I mean, what I think Giuliani's sort of boosters don't like to talk about, but that, you know, other observers have said to me, is the idea that they have maybe a kind of firewall of anti-Mormon sentiment in South Carolina that can help them. Because certainly, I mean, Giuliani has a big lead there, in which, unlike these sort of, you know, big state primaries, it's not like South Carolina has a, you know, less socially conservative electorate than the rest of the country. But nonetheless, Romney's doing quite poorly there.
Well, but here's the thing. You know, You saw that that Pew poll, it was from July, where, you know, a really quite astonishing number of Republican voters still don't know that Rudy Giuliani's pro-choice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, I forget the exact number, but okay. It was something... I mean, the question was a little...
Well, yeah, I mean, that is why the early primaries matter, right? I mean, because if Romney wins in Iowa, and then the story out of Iowa is Romney wins in Iowa because he's pro-life and Rudy Giuliani isn't. Right. Well, then more people learn, right?
Whatever the percentage of voters who know that Rudy Giuliani's pro-choice, that number is going to go up
right.
by the end of the campaign, the end of the primary campaign. And it seems to me that if you don't know that he's pro-choice and you're a Republican voter, you probably don't know that he's got a record on gun control you just probably dislike, a record on immigration you probably dislike, that he opposed NAFTA, that he supported Cuomo. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there. There is a lot of room to build on Giuliani's negatives.
Sure.
I just don't know how much room there is to build on Romney's negatives from being a Mormon. I tend to think that the people who are highly motivated against Mormonism, you know, that we may have
know
reached
about
that
already,
limit.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, you know, I mean, I wrote yesterday that I saw, you know, they have these betting markets on stuff,
yeah.
and you can buy Mitt Romney at 22 cents on the dollar, you know. And I said I wasn't going to do it myself because political journalists are supposed to pretend we're influential, but that certainly seemed like a good pickup to me. Then after I wrote that, I got a lot of pushback from people suggesting that, you know, this Giuliani fade hadn't happened as all of we liberals had been expecting it to. But if you say...
Well, the interesting thing about those markets is that, and I think you must be talking about the in-trade market, is that Thompson's been falling. Thompson and Romney are now at rough parity, and I think one of the questions of the next few months is going to be one of them, I think, has to get rid of the other in order for... in order for it to happen for either one of them.
Right.
Just to sort of, on a lower level, Brownback and Huckabee have to do the same thing in order to even make a real ripple.
Right. I mean, Thompson, I don't know, kind of seems like a bit of a phantom menace. You know, once he got in, all of a sudden his campaign didn't seem as appealing.
Well, you know, if you can't get... Look, I don't think there's any great strategic reason for the delay in actually launching other than that he is not ready to launch. He doesn't have the stuff in place. And if you can't do that, you know, granted it's a difficult task, but if you can't do that, I mean, how formidable a candidate are you really going to be?
Right.
It's getting late, and it's gotten to the point where I think people have gotten a little sick of the when's he going to jump in.
Right.
Not speculation.
Also just, I mean, you know, I don't know. I voted for Mitt Romney when I lived in Massachusetts and when Mitt Romney was much more liberal. But, you know, he's a good politician. He, you know, gives good speeches. He has a pretty good record in these things. I never quite saw what that opening was exactly that Fred Thompson...
Fewer flip-flops, right? You know, the more consistently conservative candidate. That would be it.
Right. But, you know, I mean, given that, you know, Romney, right. But, I don't know. I mean, this is your issues rather than mine. It just seems to me that whatever one thinks about Romney's sort of depth of commitment to life issues and whatever else, that, you know, he's clearly signaled a desire to govern as a pro-life politician, in a way that, you know, doesn't give me as a pro-choicer any doubt that, you know,
that's what he'll do.
The fact that, you know, he was in a completely different context, willing to promise to do the reverse, doesn't give me any doubts here.
It is very hard to come up with an explanation for the evolution of Mitt Romney's views that reflects credibly on his character. But
sure.
I mean, as a hard-headed pro-lifer, all I would care about is... Well, I guess two things. One, how does it affect his electability? And I think the flip-flop thing actually hurts him substantially. And number two, could he flip back? And I tend to think that it would be very hard for him to flip back if he were president. I think that if he were president, he actually would govern as a pro-lifer.
Right. I mean,
I don't have that concern that a lot of my fellow pro-lifers do.
Right. I mean, it's just hard to see what the rationale for that would be. I mean, I think, you know, cultural conservatism is a pretty good electoral issue for Republicans nationwide. To be surrounded by, you know, culturally conservative people.
Congressman voted sincerely on the basis of their own views on abortion issues, I think in general, pro-lifers would do much worse in those votes than they do.
Right. I mean, that's certainly a possibility. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like an electability problem. You know, since his official story about this really doesn't make sense.
Well, the trouble for Mitt Romney, one of the problems for him is that his primary vulnerabilities are also general election vulnerabilities. I don't think that's true, say, of John McCain, which is, you know, one of the reasons I sort of supported his candidacy.
Right.
You know, the attacks from the right just wouldn't have any purchase in a general election.
Right.
But with Romney, the two basic problems are the flip-flopping and the Mormonism, and I see both of those as just serious general election problems.
Right, yes. No, I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, Romney is the Republican I'm rooting for, since I think he'd make a better president than these other guys, and also a much weaker general election candidate. So, you know, I'm feeling good about his early primary leads. You know,
You think Giuliani would be a stronger candidate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, Giuliani, I think, gives Democrats everywhere sort of nightmares. You know, the thought that he would put a whole range of, you know, states back in play that haven't been in play, and that, you know, maybe if John Edwards were the nominee, you could sort of flip the script on Giuliani in that regard and try and expand the map in terms of winnable Democratic states. But, you know, I don't see... I mean, a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama, I feel like, is going to lose culturally conservative voters to Rudy Giuliani no matter what. But the Democrats have built up this big advantage. I mean, have sort of... This whole kind of slice of the Reagan coalition mm-hmm. has defected to Democrats, you know, suburban voters in New Jersey and Connecticut, places like that, who, you know, I think could very plausibly vote for Rudy Giuliani.
See, I think a platform of social liberalism, free market economics, and endless war is not a winning platform.
I think so, too.
Particularly right now.
I mean, on generic terms, I agree that that's a really bad platform, and I don't think like a generic candidate who did that would do
but
it.
But Rudy, just because he's Rudy, would.
Well, because Rudy still has, come on, there's a certain political appeal, I think, always to sort of nationalism and hawkishness on foreign policy, even though that appeal's reduced. Giuliani still gets very just good ratings from a general public on terrorism and national security issues in a way that seemed completely undeserved to me. But you know, he has it. And I think does an okay job of tapping into some of what, you know, cultural conservatism is all about, while, you know, still being pro-choice in a way that's reassuring to people. I don't know, though. I mean, a year ago, I thought exactly what you just said, that this was ridiculous, that what Giuliani has done has gotten the less popular side of all the different issues.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I still think that's the case, and I'm heartened by you know, as an anti Giuliani guy, that by the poll showing continued Republican ignorance of his positions.
Of his
you know, look, I mean, we're also at a point where it's Romney versus Thompson, it's Huckabee versus Brownback, and nobody's really yet had to land any solid blows against Giuliani.
I thought Giuliani got off really easy in the immigration debate, for example.
Oh, yeah.
His rivals let him get away with a fairly ridiculous misrepresentation of his record. I was living in New York when he sued the federal government for the right to not enforce any immigration laws whatsoever.
Yeah, Romney hit him over that a week
right.
or so ago.
Right.
And the pushback from the Giuliani campaign has been really laughable. Basically, it's been, well, other cities were sanctuary cities, too.
Sure,
yeah,
right.
Well,
I mean,
the mayor of Tampa is not running for the Republican nomination.
No, I mean, exactly. I mean, he's taken out a position that's way to the left of anything that a Democrat would try to pull off in national politics. And, you know, I don't know if that would hurt him in a general election. Certainly, it seems like it could be deadly in a primary. If people came to understand it. But I feel like sort of, not you personally, but institutions like the one you work for have been a little bit oddly soft on Giuliani, given his record.
Well, you know, part of it is that we're a New York-based magazine at National Review, and New York conservatives, you know, they seem to think that he saved their lives,
almost literally
from crime, and even in some sort of way. Some sort of psychological way they feel it about terrorism.
Uh-huh.
But the you know, the interesting question will be, I mean, it does seem as though, I mean, look, what he's really, look, there's a lot of things where one might wish he had had more scrutiny. He's gotten a lot of scrutiny on the abortion question.
Right.
But on the security front itself, you know, I'm a relatively hawkish voter. I don't see what is supposed to be so weak about Hillary Clinton or so strong about Rudy Giuliani. I mean, you know, yeah, he doesn't like terrorists, and he's a tough SOB, but, you know, it's not like he's got a great deal of foreign policy experience, and I don't think that Hillary Clinton is going to be running as a dove.
No, I mean, in this weird way, I think Clinton and Giuliani, in a slightly odd way, but would be running with, you know, very similar positions on national security, right? I mean, they would both be candidates who were, in some sense, in favor of a very forward-leaning posture in Iraq, but against how it turned out, and both making the argument that they, a sort of competence and strength and experience argument, in a way that, you know, I sort of don't know. It seems like kind of a wash. But, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of the politics of national security, I think, are pretty purely irrational. And Giuliani has, you know, more so than anyone, more so than even Bush,
has benefited from the irrationality.
A strong emotional identification with Giuliani's rhetorical performance at a very disturbing time in American life. And, you know, I remember myself as a Democrat, a liberal, but you know, also a New Yorker and something, finding the fact that Bush was in the White House very unnerving, his performance initially in those days, like
the night of September 11th in particular, with the
not reassuring, and then Giuliani as like a steadying presence who, you know, made me feel better about the world, you know, and that's a formidable advantage, even if it doesn't like make sense on some level.
Yeah, but you know, again, one wonders how it'll wear.
Right.
You know, it's, I think that there are a lot of attacks that could be made on him in a general election. There's just a huge record of things. And, you know, occasionally you'll hear people say, well, you know, the multiple marriages won't be a problem because he'll be running against Hillary Clinton, for goodness sake. And I just think that's absurd.
Well, sure. Well, that's backwards. Right.
No, I mean, the voters who would actually be more inclined to take that into consideration when they vote, they're Republican voters and Republican-leaning voters. So, you know, it's not like there's mutually assured destruction. It would hurt the Republican candidate far more.
Right. No, plus, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that, like, Hillary did the... I mean, it casts Giuliani's behavior into a kind of relief, right? I mean, you have a woman who's committed to her marriage.
She's the wronged woman, and he's the man who keeps wronging women.
Right, exactly. And, you know, she's the person who's committed to marriage and to family, sort of beyond transient personal feelings about this and that, and he's very much not.
I almost want Giuliani to get the nomination just to finally prove that the gender gap is not about abortion.
Okay.
Because I do suspect that that at the end of the day, he would end up having having much stronger appeal to men than to women in the general election.
So we'll vote for Giuliani as a kind of social science experiment.
It's yeah,
dangerous.
Right.
It's always dangerous.
Well, the D.C. primary does not tend to determine Republican nominations.
Right. Okay. Well, should we wrap it up?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sweet. Good to talk to you.
As always.
All right.
Take care.